Welcome to Game Changers. I'm Noam Weissman, head of education here at Unpacked. And today we have Tal Ben-Shahar with us. Tal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Noam. It's great to be here.
Before we get started with this conversation, I want to make sure that everyone subscribes to us on YouTube at youtube.com/unpacked. And you can find us on Instagram at unpacked.media and at unpackedmedia on Twitter. Tal Ben-Shahar is famous for lots of things, some powerful books on happiness, and having been the professor of, at the time, the most well-attended class at Harvard with 855 students. So, Tal, thank you so much for joining us. And how are you feeling today? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay, all things considered, experiencing the ups and downs, a bit of a roller coaster, but I think many of us are.
Yes, I'm definitely one of those people. But I want to jump right into a question that I have for you. How do you find happiness in tough times? Is it an attitude? Is it an experience? How do you do it? How do you find happiness in tough times?
Yeah, so, you know, the challenge is, if not to find happiness, to increase our happiness levels or to increase our well-being. And there are many things that we can do in order to do so. The first thing is to accept any and all emotions. You know, one of the things that happens in difficult times like these is that emotions become more extreme and more complex. So, for example, people are experiencing more anxiety than usual, whether it's over their health, their loved ones' health, whether it's about financial security going into the future. So there is more anxiety. At the same time, there is also more gratitude that many people are feeling, or sometimes even happiness and joy. However, very often with the gratitude or with the joy comes guilt. Mm. How can I be grateful now? How can I be happy now when so many other people are struggling? So more extreme emotions and more complex. And the key to handling this this flood of complexity is by giving ourselves what I've come to call the permission to be human. Allowing ourselves to experience any and all emotions. Because you know what happens when we reject emotions, when we reject painful emotions like frustration or like anxiety, these emotions intensify. It's when we accept, when we embrace them, that they don't overstay their welcome and they flow out just as they flowed in.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So that's a new way to perceive, I think, how to deal with our own emotions. Because one of the things I was thinking about is if you had, that's one piece of practical advice. I was wondering if you had other pieces of practical advice on how to help people regulate their emotions and how to help people maybe increase ways to find happiness in their lives, whether it's through moments of gratitude or dealing with the challenges that they have.
Yeah. So while the first step is to embrace and accept any and all emotions, again, painful or pleasurable, the second step is to actively seek or inspire well-being. For example, a regular physical exercise. You know, usually when I ask people, when are the times when you're least likely to exercise, they would say, well, when I'm very busy, when I'm very stressed. Well, these are the most important times to exercise. Now is such a time. So exercise, whether it's going outside if you can or if you have to stay indoors, then doing one of the thousands of programs that are available on YouTube. The key is to move it. Moving it, exercising has the same effect on our psychological well-being as our most powerful psychiatric medication. Additionally, expressing gratitude on a regular basis. People who keep a gratitude journal, whether it's every day or even once a week, are happier, more optimistic, more successful. Their immune system is actually stronger. They're physically healthier and they are kinder and more generous, more pleasant to be around. So there are many benefits to expressing gratitude. And that could be, this is the idea behind Moderni. You know, start your day with a gratitude prayer and your day will be a lot happier and healthier. In addition, another thing is relationships. Relationships are the number one predictor of well-being. And it's very difficult to have the kind of relationships or to express our relationships in the same way as we do normally, by being together, by hugging, and so on. However, if they have to be virtual, then so be it. Make the best of the situation.
Right. You know, what you mentioned, when you think about the gratitude journals and the concept of Mode Ani in Judaism, waking up every morning, and before we do anything, we just say, thank you. And maybe we could like add to that and say more ideas and be specific about the things that we're grateful for. I was thinking about something a little bit more complicated. I recently read ideas from Yuval Noah Harari, and I might be misrepresenting them. But one of the things that I remember thinking about is he essentially argues that, you know what, just increased dopamine, if happiness is really just about something that's chemical in our bodies, then all we theoretically might need to do is, you know, not just tell our kids a good night story, which could lead to happiness, or if we're teenagers, other things that might lead to joy or well-being or happiness. But we could just have more dopamine. Why don't we just take dopamine pills? So what's your response to that?
No, one of the things that that I do in developing the whole field of happiness studies, which I'm doing through the Happiness Studies Academy, is dispute many of the conventions about what happiness is and is not. So many people equate happiness with pleasure, with a good feeling, and in which case, yeah, just, you know, inject the dopamine, increase the serotonin, and you're all good. Happiness is much more than that. Happiness also has to do with a sense of meaning and purpose. Now, we don't always experience pleasure when we're doing something meaningful. You know, you take an athlete for whom it's very meaningful to excel. They go through a lot of emotional pain in order to achieve their goals. Now, are they not happy? No, they're very happy. They're fulfilled, because happiness is much more than just the good feeling, just the pleasure. Happiness is about meaning. Happiness is about relationships. Happiness is about learning and growing. These are all important components of happiness. In other words, happiness is not a unidimensional construct, i.e. just pleasure. Happiness is a multidimensional construct, and we need to take all the elements into consideration, pleasure being one of them, but it's just one of them.
So I you know, as a former high school principal with, you know, 13 to 17 year olds, and as an adult and having young kids myself, one of the things that I wonder is, are there different approaches to happiness and to living a life of well-being for different ages? Do you suggest different approaches, or is there a general principle? It's about relationships, or it's about gratitude. What would you suggest?
Yeah, the basic principles of a happy life are similar for different ages as well as for different cultures. However, when it comes to particulars, that's where we find a difference. So, for instance, you know, when you're a child, you're a young child, your happiness doesn't come from changing the world or doing something for the greater good, you know, when you're maybe 5 or even 10 years old. And when you're 17 or even 15, you do think about the greater good. In other words, a sense of meaning and purpose is important for a 5-year-old and for a 15-year-old, as well as for a 55-year-old. However, where you find your meaning, that's different for different age groups. So meaning is important for every age as well as universally. Physical health, well-being is important. So, you know, when children don't even think about it, they just play and they run around. You know, adults perhaps need to be more deliberative about getting their physical well-being fix.
Yeah.
However, the principles are similar across the lifespan.
So I understand that you were a serious athlete growing up. And I've been watching, I don't know if you have, I've been watching the Last Dance about Michael Jordan and the last championship that the Chicago Bulls won in 97-98. And I was thinking about it in terms of well-being and happiness, because, Michael Jordan was very tough on his teammates. And we live in a world in which everyone gets trophies. And I think that what's happening perhaps is that adults want to make sure that kids are happy. Does that work? Does that not work? Is there a certain approach that we missed from 25 years ago of a more less, let's say, democratic. What do you suggest in terms of what adults should be doing with young people in terms of happiness?
Yeah, there's a pervasive problem in our culture today, specifically when it comes to parenting. And that is that parents perceive their role as making life easy and pleasant for their children. Now, easy and pleasant is easy and pleasant, but it's not necessarily conducive to growth, to development, and ultimately to happiness. Think about it this way. You know, you go to the gym and you lift weights, and the weights are really easy. There is absolutely no resistance. You're not going to benefit from lifting weights. You're not going to get stronger. You're not going to get more resilient. You're not going to get healthier. You need some resistance, some hardship, not just in the gym, also in life. Children learn their most important lessons through struggles. Maria Montessori, the great educator, once said, "Never do for a child what the child can do for him or herself." If a child can struggle through something and achieve it by themselves, that's what they need to do. Why? Because that's how they become stronger. That's how they cultivate self-esteem and self-confidence, and they learn that they are capable. And when parents come in to quote-unquote save their child whenever they're facing a little bit of challenge or trouble, they're not helping their children. They're hurting their children. So children need more struggle rather than more help. I want to share a story with you that has been very important for me in my parenting. And when David, our eldest son, was 3 years old, he had a favorite doll. It was a little Superman doll. And he would go with it everywhere. He would take it to daycare at night. It would sleep right next to him on his pillow. He would talk to it. It was his BFF, best friend forever. So he had David. And I remember one day my wife and I brought him back home from daycare. And we went into our apartment building. We went into the elevator, lived on the 10th floor, went up, and my wife and I are chatting, and David is with his Superman doll, you know, talking to him, more interesting. And then we walk out of the elevator, and as he walks out, Superman drops. Now, that Superman couldn't really fly. It was a hoax. So he falls down, and he falls down the shaft of the elevator, never to be resurrected. Now, David begins to cry. And I'm about to say something to David, and my wife stops me, puts her hand on my hand. She, as I think many wives, she knows what I'm about to say before I even say it. What I was about to say was, "David, don't worry. I'll get you another Superman doll. I'll get you another 100 Superman dolls. You know, I don't worry." We walk into the house. He goes into his room. He continues to cry. And I say to my wife, I say, "Tommy, why did you stop me? Listen to him." And she said to me the following sentence. She said, "Tal, do not deprive David of the opportunity to learn from hardship. Not deprive David of the opportunity to learn from hardship." And that was a very important lesson. And she's absolutely right. If he's able to learn to regulate his emotions without daddy's help, that's so much better. That's the much bigger gift to him than a $2 Superman doll.
Is your wife a positive psychologist as well?
You know, she is. You know, I had to study it officially for 20 years. You know, right. She didn't. She's a natural.
Okay, I got you. Wow, that's a powerful story. And I've made that mistake probably 75 times, and my son is only 7. So
we all make those mistakes. Right. I was once telling a psychology friend of mine when David was 6, I said to her, "You know, Shirley, I wish I'd known all the things that I know today when David was born, because then I wouldn't have made all those mistakes." She looks at me and says, "Tal, don't worry. You would have made other mistakes."
That's the wisdom.
And it's an important statement, because very often it is through our mistakes that they learn to cope with an imperfect world. And again, the world is not a perfect place, and better they learn to deal with it early on than later on.
So you grew up in Israel. Did growing up in Israel teach you anything about happiness and well-being?
Growing up in Israel taught me the most important lessons when it comes to happiness and well-being. See, there is a lot of research today on the happiest countries in the world. And the happiest countries in the world are countries like Denmark, Norway, Costa Rica, Australia, and Israel. And the question is, why these countries and not others? You know, why Israel when, you know, we have our fair share of challenges? So why Colombia with their the issues that they're going through? And the answer is that the number one predictor of happiness on a national level, relationships, social support. Growing up, my first memories have to do with relationships, with obviously with my friends, and also with friends coming over to our house, to my parents or to us, and staying over. It's a communal society. And this emphasis on relationships is, to my mind, and again, this is what the research shows, the most important thing we can learn and practice if our concern is happiness.
So that's the internet. What I remember reading about is that's the concept of hygge, right? H-Y-G-G-E, of spending real time with one another and things like that. Is that right?
Yes. You find, for example, in Denmark, that 93% of Danes are members of social clubs, active members of social clubs. So community there is important, and that explains happiness levels. In Israel, you know, we meet people, whether it's, you know, we're at my parents every Friday night with the whole mishpucha, whether it's the chevre, the friends that are together a lot, and we go out. You know, I remember one of my business partners who's British, came to spend a few days in Israel, and so he was there throughout the week, and then he came again and again, and on the third time he said, "Tal, you guys in Israel, you're always partying," and I must say I didn't know what he was talking about, because he didn't come over, you know, holidays. He wasn't there over Yom HaTzmaut or Purim, when we, you know, really party. So I asked him, you know, what do you mean? And he says, you're always going out. You're always meeting friends. And you know, we take it for granted in Israel, and we shouldn't.
That's a great point. And I think another point that you mentioned is the social aspect, where you said 93% of Danes are part of some sort of social group. It's also true that in Israel, there's a gigantic social group called the IDF, you know, which has mandatory is the Defense Forces of Israel. I wonder, do you think that that contributes positively or negatively to an individual's well-being, to an individual's psychology, to their happiness?
Yeah, going through the 3-year or 2-year mandatory service in Israel does overall, in most cases, of course, not in all cases, but in most cases does overall contribute to well-being. Why? First of all, you're with people your own age, you're hanging out together. It's a real, you know, social scene, sometimes in very stressful situations. However, you're still together. Second, you're doing something that is meaningful, something that is important to, something that presumably you believe in. Well, a sense of meaning and purpose is a major predictor of a happy life, and you encounter that meaningful experience at a relatively young age. Third, you also learn to appreciate life more. You know, I remember when I came to college in the US, I was just shocked by people, by other students' complaint of the dining hall food. For me, it was gourmet. You know, they haven't experienced army food. it's not that bad, but it's not as good as college food. So you learn to appreciate, you know, the little things, which are not so little.
I want to quibble with something here. There's a phrase in the Mishnah, which is rabbinic law, rabbinic ideas, from Avot. in which there's a phrase that says, Ezehu Ashir Hasameach Bechoko, which means, who is rich? He who is happy with his or her lot. Is that true? Is there a certain threshold that you have to earn in order to actually feel that way? Ezehu Ashir Hasameach Bechoko. Is it perhaps also the case that if you're not earning a certain amount, if you're below a certain threshold, that you can't actually feel that way? Or do you say, no, actually, this rabbinic statement is true, totally?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of research and conversation around the relationship between wealth and happiness. And generally, what the research shows is the following. It shows that money doesn't matter for happiness, except for providing for our basic needs.
Okay.
So, you know, if there's a person who has no money and you to bring, you know, bread, food to their families, and you give them an extra $1,000 a month, of course, that's going to contribute to their well-being, to their happiness. However, once basic needs are met, money doesn't contribute to happiness.
Wow.
Now, does that negate the idea that Ezehu Ashir Asameach Bechelko, you know, who is rich, the one who's happy, satisfied with his her lot? No, there is a lot to it. Much of happiness is determined by your ability to savor, to appreciate what we have. And therefore, you have very wealthy, very successful individuals that seemingly have it all and who are miserable.
Wow.
And yet you have people who have very little and yet never cease to celebrate life. And in other words, it's our subjective evaluation of what we have that's actually more important than what we have objectively.
Is happiness genetic at all? Is there a genetic element to this?
Yes, there is a very strong genetic element to happiness. You know, some people are born with the quote unquote happy genes, others are not. I often tell my students that I'm the right person to teach happiness. Why? Because I wasn't born with happy genes. In other words, I have to work on it. You know, I must say that there's no doubt in my mind that if I was born with happy genes, we wouldn't be talking now. I would be, you know, probably the programming in some startup somewhere. It's because of my own unhappiness that I became interested in studying and teaching ultimately happiness. So yes, genes do matter a great deal. At the same time, they do not determine our level of happiness. They simply present us with the starting conditions. And based on these starting conditions, there is a lot that we can do. How? By the choices that we make. And quite literally, at every moment in our life, we have a choice. The choice, for example, to appreciate or to take for granted. That's very important for happiness. The choice whether to pursue a goal, an objective, an outcome that is meaningful to us, or something that other people think we should, or that we think will yield the most, accolades. These are important choices. Or the choice to be nice to someone. That's an important choice, because when we're nice to someone, we also contribute ultimately to our own happiness. Giving, one of the best ways of increasing levels of well-being, is through generosity, gemilut chasadim, helping the other. You know, my favorite word in Hebrew is the word natan, which is to give. And the reason is because if you look at natan, if you had to spell it in Hebrew letters, nun taf nun, with Roman letters would be natan. It works in both forms. What's unique about that word? It's a palindrome. It's symmetrical. It reads the same way right to left and left to right. That's no coincidence. There's a lot of wisdom in Hebrew. And it's because when I give, I'm given right back. And today we have a lot of research showing just how true that is. When we give, we receive with interest.
You know, I also think about the idea when you're talking about words, the word ahav in Hebrew means to love, and the word yahav in Aramaic means to give. And they have a similar root there. And that to me also speaks to the wisdom of the concept there.
The wisdom of ahav and yahav is very deep, the relationship between love and giving. Because obviously we give people we love. When we give those we love, it actually increases the love we have for them, and it also increases self-love. So we evaluate ourselves as more valuable when we give, when we're generous, when we're kind.
Okay, this is so important. Listen, the month of May is Mental Health Month, and to learn so much about happiness, about tools for well-being, about tools for dealing with our challenges of depression, something you said earlier about, you know, making sure we exercise exactly at the time, so where we don't want to exercise. I felt that so much in my own life, and I'm sure that that's totally universal. So much good advice. I'm going to do a rapid fire thing here with you. Tal ben Shachar's morning routine starts with
meditation, taking 10 minutes, just focusing on the breath going in and out. And that I feel creates a good foundation for the rest of the day.
One thing that the world does not know about Tal ben Shachar is
I'm a wicked backgammon player. In fact, when I served in the military, I won the Olga Open Championship.
Wow.
I should put that in my CV, actually.
That should be, yeah. Who cares about 855 students in your Harvard class? Judaism's biggest contribution to the world is
the Ten Commandments, and in particular, Shabbat. There is more and more research today showing just how important recovery, taking a day off, is for relationships, for mental health, and for physical health.
What is something people get wrong about you, Tal?
You know, when people hear what I do or attend my lectures, they very often think that I'm happy all the time, that I experience a constant high. I always remind them there are only two kinds of people who do not experience painful emotions such as sadness or anger or frustration or envy or anxiety. Two kinds of people: psychopaths and dead people. I'm neither. I experience painful emotions as well.
That's what you said earlier. You said you want to give people permission to feel the things that they feel. So
To be human.
Permission to be human. Exactly. So Tal, tell us, what are you working on next?
So I'm working on creating a happiness studies field. A field that will incorporate what psychologists have to say about happiness, what theologians have to say about it, what philosophers and neuroscientists all have to say about living the good life. Bring them all together into one coherent interdisciplinary field of study, happiness studies.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the academy?
Yes, so I co-founded the Happiness Studies Academy. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we provide a year-long certificate program that takes the student through the theory and, even more importantly, the practice of happiness studies so that they can help themselves become happier and so that they can help others increase their levels of well-being, whether it's family members, whether it's colleagues at work, whether it's students or clients.
Incredible. Tal, you've done so much for the world in helping people become happier, helping people feel what they need to feel, and giving people the permission to be human, like you say. Thank you so much for everything you do for the world. And thank you so much for joining our show, Game Changers. You really are a game changer. So thank you.
Thank you very much.